Luke, tell me what Men at War's about and why you decided to write it.
Men at War is about masculinity and sexuality and how we remember the Second World War. I decided to write it because I've always been obsessed with the war since I was very small, and building model kits and loving all of these aircraft, being quite obsessed with them, drawing them, getting all the books out of the library, and all of that sort of thing, reading war memoirs, reading war thrillers, reading, watching war films, just totally obsessed. And it's never gone away, that obsession.
It's interesting you say the word obsession. In the book, you say it often feels like Britain is stuck, and I'm quoting you here, Britain is stuck in some perpetual childlike, simplistic obsession with the war that prevented it from growing up and living in the present. Could we unpack that a little? What exactly are you accusing us of?
Well, it's not accusing anybody. I think what I'm saying is it's not saying we should forget the war. I think it's right that we're constantly picking at it because it is such a huge event in our country's past, and it still has huge impacts today, whether that's on things like Brexit or contemporary politics or what's happening in Ukraine with Russia's invasion. I think that still has its roots in the Second World War. But I felt that I wanted to look at the war in a way that was a bit more complicated and look at some of the things that maybe as that wartime generation are passing away and there's very few of them left. I do think that there's a simpler, sort of more narrow-minded view of the war, of heroics and national pride and so on, that sort of obscures the complexity of some of the people who fought and some of their stories. And some of the richness of the time, I think it's very boring to look at it in two-dimensional heroes, Churchill speeches, the iconic Dambusters raid and all these sorts of things that are just quite narrow when there was all this millions of men and women involved and it was complicated and it was all over the world. And there's a rich story and not all of it's been told yet.
As the title suggests, the book deals with men at war, masculinity, and you do cover some ground. But let's start with World War One, which really fascinated me in the book. You describe an anxiety of masculinity that was felt by those who were too young to go to the First World War. Outline what that anxiety involved and how it manifested.
Yeah, that was something that I hadn't quite expected to find in my research, was the impacts of the First World War on that Second World War generation. And it worked in many ways. And there was this constant reference to the feeling that people who had grown up too young to fight, but whose fathers had fought, felt that their masculinity was in some way not quite adequate. They'd fluffed the catch, I think somebody had written about it. And George Orwell mentions this. Elizabeth Bowen, the novelist, mentions this. Robert Graves talks about this. And I thought that was very interesting, that there was still, despite all the carnage of the First World War and how terrible it was, there was still a feeling that to have been too young meant that you weren't proven as a man. I mean, it is interesting that when you then get to the declaration of the Second World War, there's not the same enthusiasm for fighting as there was at the start of the First World War, when you had people signing up in droves at recruiting centres because people were aware of the horror of the war. So it was almost like when war was an imaginary concept that their fathers had done, they didn't really know much about it. Then there was a feeling that, oh, we've missed out on a chance to prove ourselves. But when it actually happened, there wasn't quite the same enthusiasm to join up. And then the other aspect was the trauma of the fathers of the First World War and how that impacted a lot of the men I write about in the book, which again was something I wasn't necessarily aware of in a big way. I mean, it's silly, really. It's obvious that it would have had an impact, but it wasn't really discussed.
Yeah, some of the soldiers you write came back from the First World War and had this strange panic that their young boys had been risen by women for 4 years, and that led to them being a little bit tougher, a little bit more harder as father figures.
Yeah, they felt that their boys had been in female company and they needed sort of, yeah, manning up or whatever. And then I write about, I discovered in a sort of adjacent book about, you know, there were boys who had First World War battle names on their birth certificates. So Ypres as their middle name, which is kind of really interesting that their parents wanted to instill some of that even into their identity. I'd not encountered before.
As you mentioned, World War II did come along and suddenly there's an opportunity for these men to prove themselves. But there was a sort of masculinity crisis in the Second World War too, and some of the most famous personalities from the war, like General Montgomery, expressed some doubt on the soldiers that were signing up. He thought they weren't as naturally born killers as perhaps those who had fought in the First World War.
Yeah, that was the bit. It was like when I was writing a book and reading like Montgomery, Alan Brooke, all these sort of top level army commanders sending each other these memos and letters, fretting that, you know, this generation was too soft. They've got cinema and the wireless and dancing, and they're not proper killers. They were genuinely worried that their culture had made them soft, and they were what now the similar sort of people would call them snowflakes. And at the same time, the same articles were being made in the newspaper, you know, about current generations. And I suspect this has been an argument as old as time. Like, oh goodness me, this new generation are no good. It's the same, isn't it? It's almost a joke saying, God help us if there's a war, you know, and you look at younger people. And I've probably said it jokingly, but I bet the Romans were saying this, you know.
I've seen it in the military. I've seen it in the military. People who've been in the military for 20 years will always look at recruits coming through and think they're not tough enough.
Really? There we go.
And there's no science behind it.
No.
Because they did all right, didn't they, actually, the generation of the Second World War?
They did incredibly. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely incredibly. They proved themselves.
Just a side note on that, you mentioned that in World War One, the consequence of saying I didn't want to fight was potentially being shot by your own country. By the time the Second World War comes along, that fear, that sort of stick, if you like, doesn't exist because we've stopped shooting people. And that's got an impact as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's that slight difference in the Second World War where you, for the British and the Americans, being democracies, you have to encourage people to fight. You can't really stick. You have to use carrot, not less stick, I suppose, on the blunt level. And yeah, you know, that was one of the other aspects of the book, was one of my grandfathers was a conscientious objector, and I wanted to examine that and the ideas of pacifism, because I always struggled with that. He was conscientious objector and pacifist on religious grounds. He was a very strong Christian, and I just never could quite understand this. Like, surely it was sometimes a Christian duty to fight evil. And I think writing the book made me understand him a lot more. Yeah, and the other grandfather, he was a railwayman, and he got put in reserved occupation and went sent out to Freetown to work on the railways over there.
Newspapers called those who'd volunteered to fight some of the finest types of British manhood, which infers those who didn't were the total opposite. But tell me a little bit about those you write about in the book who did sign up to fight, and some of the struggles some of those people had with their mental health due to the nature of their service. You recall one individual who pulled up on the runway before his aircraft took off and just took ill, and he was taken away, and I believe he was court-martialed.
Yeah, I mean, that was in one of the memoirs about 158 Squadron, which is a real focus, Bomber Command Squadron, which is a real focus of the book. And that was recounted in one of the memoirs where I think it was a rear gunner said, oh, my radio's not working. They were sort of, yes, it is. All my eyes are playing up. And then they had to stop and dispersal, get a replacement gunner while this guy was taken away. And because they were so far behind the rest of the bomber force, by the time they got to the target, everything was aware of what was happening, and they were incredibly badly shot up and nearly didn't make it back. But the fellow crew member who wrote that memoir, when the guy who'd obviously cracked and couldn't do it anymore, when he was court-martialed, the crew member who'd had nearly died, essentially, because of his not being able to fight, was very forgiving and felt that the people making the judgment on him had they'd not flown these missions themselves. They had no idea what it was like, and there should have been more empathy for this guy. So I thought that was very interesting, particularly the context of Bomber Command, with, you know, lack of moral fibre.
The official designation.
The official designation that could be used if you refuse to fly, which is a real, you know, lack of moral fibre. It's a real saying, you are not man enough. That really feels like a judgment on your character.
It does show these leap forwards, sort of 50-year leap forwards at a time, if you like. World War One, you can't fight because you just physically can't. You're physically unable to carry on. It's cowardice. You're put against the wall and shot. World War Two, we talked about the designation that the Royal Air Force came up for its individuals. It didn't result in being shot, but you were court-martialed. And now we can take this, you know, most contemporarily, and mental health of the armed forces is paramount. It's hugely significant. And there's also an acknowledgement now that the generations before us, who we're also talking about now, got it completely wrong.
Yeah, and it's very interesting if you look at the sort of history of army military psychiatry. Like, after the First World War, they'd made some progress, and then it sort of all went quiet. Nobody bothered studying it again. And the Second World War brought it to the forefront, and there was more discussion, more experimental psychiatry, some of which was quite brutal, like enforced grieving, which was something they used to do to tank commanders who'd cracked up, where you'd put them in a dark room for days and only give them bread and water so they could to force them to grieve for their lost crews. And it obviously didn't work very well. And then I think it went quiet again, and it was the research after Vietnam very much led us to understanding PTSD and, you know, contemporary therapies and probably a far better treatment for that now.
So there are many individuals profiled in the book who shun the construct of masculinity or of what we have come to understand as masculinity. What was it like getting the opportunity to look closely at some of these individuals?
I found it incredibly moving to get to look at these lives very closely. Some are familiar-ish, others hadn't been considered in the way I was doing it, but there were some men who hadn't really been thought about for years, probably. People like Henry Danton, who didn't fight. He said he had a physical aversion to fighting. He wasn't a coward and he wasn't a conscientious objector. He just couldn't do it. And I found him to be a very moving figure. And I actually got to interview him a year before he died, and it was a really powerful experience. And then Bertram War, who was a sergeant in Bomber Command, who was a poet and really saw himself as a pacifist, or was a pacifist, but eventually joined Bomber Command and was a bomb aimer in Halifax.
Male companionship is another topic you're looking at closely in the book. There's something rather innocently homoerotic about a passage you repeat from the Infantry Training Manual of 1932, and it reads, "On and off parade, the men should work and play as a member of his section and not as an individual."
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't actually thought of that as being homoerotic, but it sort of is. There's this idea of all these different people who are thrown together with nothing in common in their lives, maybe, and being forced to get on in very close physical proximity. And I do think that's a very rare situation. It doesn't happen, I don't think, in civilian life very much in the same way, because of the intimacy and because of the life and death being sort of a fine margin.
You discuss nudity and the inevitability of nudity in the military when men are billeted together or serving together. A really interesting observation that you raise is that it was the posh soldiers,
yeah,
who found it easier to take their clothes off in front of other men, while the working class guys from the north were sort of cowering in the corner.
Yeah, that was something I learned, was that Dudley Cave, a soldier, writes about how, you know, he went to private school, so everyone was perfectly used to it, whereas Kenneth Williams, he was very nervous at first. What is all this nudity going on? And then he got used to it, as people would do, because you had no choice but to get very used to it. There was a lot of class divisions around the body and sexuality in the war, definitely, because I think, you know, homosexuality was seen as being a private school thing. Like everybody did it at a private school, but wider culture, wider society, people didn't so much. There was a strong class divide around lots of things to do with the body.
You know, you mentioned homosexuality. There's evidence that within the fighting ranks of the military, homosexual soldiers were more or less accepted. And you argue that actually it was the more effeminate gays that had an easier of time.
I don't know about an easier time, but there was a certain sense that they were tolerated. And whether there was an acceptance, both from the comrades, fellow service people, and a tolerance from above. Dudley Cave wrote after the war, when he was really fighting for the acceptance of gay men and women in the military, saying, you know, the government used us then because they needed the manpower, then brought back in the intolerance. And it was only sort of in the 90s when that changed.
Some of the powers that be did have some concern, obviously. The Admiralty issued out orders to the Royal Navy early on in the war, citing military law that was written in the 17th century.
But then again, the mainstream British civilian legal system was still similarly based on old laws around sexuality and judgment around sexuality. But yeah, I find it bizarre that someone in the Admiralty building, you know, amidst all these other fleet orders that they were transmitting all the way around the world, typed out this sort of edict about how you must prosecute and persecute, essentially, any gay men you found on your ship or in your shore-based establishment.
It all seems just so extraordinary via the lens of 2023.
It does, and I wonder if it actually felt extraordinary then, because if I quote a historian who points out there was less than 2,000 convictions by a court-martial during the war, and if you think for homosexuality, and if you think of the millions and millions of people for all those years who were in the military, for there to have been so few convictions, now, whether that was just because it was waste of administrative and legal time to prosecute gay men, or people just thought, oh, we don't need to do that because we need these people to fight. It's interesting, though, that there was just so few prosecutions.
It does underline the purpose of your book, though, and that is to challenge the narrative of masculinity that's set in the Second World War.
Yeah, I think I wanted to say that these were people who were a lot more complicated than either the sort of stiff upper lip types you see in war films or the idea of quiet heroes. You know, they did their bit, they came home, they were silent, they got married, they had the baby boomers, they had a life in insurance, retired, and are now dying. And I think, to my mind, the reality of the masculinity of those war years was richer and more vivid. It was kind of funnier, more saucy, more erotic, just a lot more unctuous in a way, you know, and I just really wanted to sort of celebrate that and say this was a very strange time of rich masculinity and very diverse masculinity.
This idea that they were all white, middle-class toffs is actually for the birds.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the RAF, obviously, it had that more sort of upper-class thing at the start of the war, but the needs must, and then they, you know, people were able to come in who weren't like that. And, you know, I didn't touch so much on the book in all the Caribbean pilots who came in, people from all over the world, in non-white servicemen. And the RAF, once it lifted the colour bar, had all sorts of people from all over the world, lots of different races involved in flying. I kind of felt that there's historians now really writing a lot and coming out with new research into sort of black servicemen in the RAF, and I felt that was... I can write about sexually complicated British people, but it was there someone else's story to tell that about the non-white servicemen.
Some might accuse you of being controversial, not just by being brave enough to talk about these incredible people who were different in the Second World War. I thought again and again in the book, you pause and you just question the role of ourselves today in the way we remember this difficult history. But you'd be keen to stress, you're not a pacifist.
No, and that's the big question that the book was posing, I think, was would the process of writing this book really turn me away from war? Would I think that these machines were horrific? Would I just be revolted by it? And what was interesting was that it didn't happen at all. Because the book is an interrogation of myself in that way. But it's also an interrogation of the country, because I do feel that the Second World War and the memory of the Second World War and those who fought is exploited politically a lot of the time. And I'm uncomfortable with that. It didn't lead me to a form of pacifism. It hasn't at all. And, you know, I had a little boy while writing it, and he's named after his great-grandfather who nearly died in the Holocaust and only just escaped and ended up being in the Red Army as they went back into Poland and Germany. And he is strangely an argument against pacifism for me, because his family would not exist. He would not exist, my wife would not exist, were it not for the fact that the war had defeated Nazism.
So what do you say to... And I'm afraid I think it's going to be inevitable. Some people will criticise having to be challenged with their set ideas about who these people were that flew these incredible machines, who drove tanks over trenches. What are you going to say to people who want to criticise you for talking about them?
I don't mind being criticised for the political points that I suppose I make in the book. I hope they actually properly read it. I think there can be a lot of reflexive... commentary on a book like this. I didn't set out to be controversial at all. My whole aim with the book was to be utterly respectful to that wartime generation, because I have a huge respect for them. I just wanted to see them in a different way. And I know for some people that's going to be difficult. I can take criticism. I just hope before the criticism is made, they actually read it and think about it, just as I've done, kind of looking at these different histories. Because it's what we should do. It's what remembrance is about. It's about reflection. It's not about jingoism or holding up the generation as the greatest or whatever. They were a generation like any other. I'm sure if a similar situation arose today, another generation would be just as brave. I don't doubt it.
Let's ask that question. Would today's generation be able to deal with something like a world war if it were to happen tomorrow?
I mean, I think there's a technological problem that if a world war happened tomorrow, we might not have very long to think about it. And if it became a nuclear war, I think they would cope with it. I don't have any doubt about that. Or you've got to look at Ukraine for a case study. There's people in Ukraine who were writers and floaty people like me or whatever, and ordinary students and mechanics and all sorts of people have gone in to defend their country and are doing it very bravely and having success against overwhelming force. And I do feel that the generation here would be able to do that too. I think it's unfortunate some of the same people who have these very narrow views of the Second World War that I'm criticising are also say that these young people who are, you know, interested in LGBT things or curse the word woke or whatever, they think, oh, that means they can't fight. And I think, no, it means they're just like them and they would do it if the time came.
And I just think it's important to just remind ourselves that those young men in 1939 who had to step up and take on the challenge, there were doubters and they did it.
Absolutely, yeah, so many of them had. It wasn't like they were all gung-ho and going into it. I mean, I quote in the book, there was one survey about people's enthusiasm for fighting, and this was the army, but 7% said they were really quite keen on fighting. That's it. The rest, everyone else had reservations. They wanted to just get home, probably. And some of them, you know, it's interesting, the complexity of emotions, particularly you find in these writings of the 158 Squadron aircrew. I do find it interesting because they talk about how exciting it was and glamorous. They loved it in aspects of their work. It had a huge sex appeal. They write about that and made them more attractive to women being in Bomber Command. But they were also terrified. They lost their friends. There was a sadness. They were really complex people like we are today. And they felt a richness of emotions while they were serving.